This week on Decentralize, marketing versus making, building a career in open source. Then we talk to cryptocurrency engineer Ryan X. Charles.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
So we talked before on the podcast about sort of why I decided not to go to college, and we talked a little bit about Eric's experience too. And I imagine we kind of all had a little bit of a difficult time adjusting to maybe the culture of something like that, being the contrarians we all kind of are by nature. But something I'm always very interested in is sort of the culture of college and how young people react to it, what it does to young people. Because I and a lot of my friends write a lot about education, and one of the things we really noticed in the past week was this hashtag on Twitter that just went viral, because it's kind of the end of the school year for a lot of people, and probably some frustrated college student out there went about summarizing his experience with hashtag college in 5 words. And if you take a look at this, it just exploded, and it also showed so much discontentment with college, but also so much like apathy about it. So college in 5 words was, you know, I'm crying in the library now. Or
I could say mine. That mine would be, I have debt. Fuck off. That's
exactly. Mine. A lot of tweets like that. Tweets about, like, you know, oh yeah, I'm getting totally wasted this weekend. Or a lot of depression, a lot of
drinking,
like nihilism. Yeah, it's just really, really sad and depressing. But like the commonality of a lot of the same kind of threads you saw over and over again with these students really highlight a lot of problems I see in like the incentives of college, kind of the values of college, but also the fact that even though people recognize things like in a university system where you have very little control over what you're learning, over sort of your life in general, because you're really dependent on grades and testing sort of for your future career, people seem to really lose a lot of hope and a lot of self-control. So it was a very interesting phenomenon for me, but I kind of want to go on a little bit of a rant there and kind of... I just really want to know why people don't do anything different. I mean, we're living in a time now where there's so many opportunities to learn, whether it's online or in person with other people. There's so much more freedom for young people now. I mean, I did something with Praxis. There's things like UnCollege, even the Thiel Foundation. But you don't have to, like, go and apply to the Thiel Foundation to you know, successfully opt out of college. But I'm just absolutely surprised by how many people recognize the problems with it but don't do anything about it. And that frustrates me. But that was my little rant, my very mild rant, relatively speaking.
So there's a lot of discussion about, like, the education bubble, the higher education bubble, the fact that, you know, we have like this linear increase in spending across the board. This applies to not only just college and university systems, but all the way down to, you know, elementary school and middle school and high school and all of these systems. What we're seeing, I think, is the world is changing around the education system, right? We now have, you know, the internet. Before, I basically grew up in a library, right? Like, my dad taught me the hunger for knowledge, and that's what got me interested in things, and he taught me how to basically seek out the answers to the questions that I was having. So I basically grew up in a library. But as, like, the internet has come around and, you know, we're having all of these amazing resources, the world is changing around college. And you're seeing the thrashing and the struggling of these university systems trying to adapt, trying to fit into this world that has changed around them. And the reality is that there is no way that they can adapt to this. Like, this is a fundamentally radical change to the way society works. Never before has information been literally at the fingertips of someone sitting at a keyboard. You can access the wealth of human knowledge and, you know, many other things as well. But it starts at a very early age, and you have to teach people about the value of that knowledge, and you inspire that curiosity in people. We've got all the tools we need to provide a significantly better education than the university can do today. So,
and I wonder if all this pent up frustration among young people is, like, they realize that they've grown up with the internet. They notice that they can learn without it, but they've been told all their life they have to go to college.
Yep.
I wonder if they feel like, it seems like they feel like very trapped. And one thing we've talked about in the past on this show is actually Peter Thiel's criticisms of higher education. And he put it this way, that, you know, we're fighting over a smaller and smaller pie, so to speak. You know, the power of college for signaling, economic value for building networks, for learning especially, has really declined. But people are now competing more than ever and earlier than ever. And it's just, it's either for the high achievers really, you know, burning them out in a lot of cases, especially in Ivy League schools. But, and even for the lower achievers, it just sort of makes it lower. Again, I use lower achiever in quotes because we don't always have the same standards for what achievement is. Some people don't necessarily want to get good grades, and that's fine. That's more than fine.
Yeah.
But it just inspires this, that I kind of like almost trapped feeling. And that's what I noticed in this hashtag, and just really, really made me think about it a lot and made me kind of like recommit to the value of showing people that there are alternatives.
Yeah. It's back to, you have to inspire people to pull out their passions, like find something that you're passionate about and then go pursue the appropriate course of action down that path.
But that starts when you're young. That doesn't start in college.
I agree.
By college, it's too late, actually.
I totally agree.
And you know, I'll say this to what everyone said is a college education, you're right. I think everyone's perception of what its value is from what they were told. Because in, you know, their parents' day, it's true. And today, it's somewhat true, too. You do have a better chance of getting a job if you have a degree. You know, it's just, it's true. It's a fact. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the better employee. This is a problem of hiring practices, which is also correlated to this perception that a college degree will prepare someone. Employers, I worked with employers for a few years in the past. They would always complain about skills gaps. And when I'd hear it, I'd kind of go, okay, so their complaint is that colleges are not really teaching the skills they need. So then colleges don't do anything about this except try to offer like programs to help. They don't change the curriculum. They don't change how you get a degree. They don't change what you learn. They don't change to a more focused path. And I think that's a shame. And I was lucky that I worked at a community college. I taught skilled trades and things where not everyone is meant to work, you know, and be an entrepreneur. I'm sorry. It's just not for everyone. Some people are so happy just working a 9-to-5 and then going home and then watching TV. That's what they want, and they want to work for a big corporation. That's all they want. If that's all they want, fine for them. But also, there are those that want to be entrepreneurs that maybe were not taught, hey, you can do this. It's not that hard. It is hard, but it's not impossible. Here's what you need.
And, you know, I wonder if some of that, though, with sort of attitude toward work is a lot of the result of training and a lot of the result of, you know, being in classrooms for a lot of life.
For farm hours, because everyone still lives on farm time.
Sure. That's a lot of prisons. I'm not even super concerned with that. I love summer vacation. I think it's one of the best things, at least as an antidote to a lot of the problems with schooling.
Yeah.
So I say if we have to keep farm hours, like, keep it. But, I mean, I do wonder what the world would be like if people... I don't think people have to be told to be entrepreneurial. I mean, in terms of like creative problem solving to create value for people, that's not something you have to train.
They
do have to train, I think, for something like 9-to-5.
I think you're onto something. I think saying that not everybody wants to be an entrepreneur, that people just want, just can be just happy doing a regular 9-to-5, going home and sitting on the couch and watching TV, I think that's a total cop out.
I disagree massively.
I think that has been beaten into us over the past 50 to 75 years after, you know, sort of the massive industrial overhaul of the way society worked. Like, I think very deeply every person on this planet has something inside of them, a fire about something that they want to go do, right? They have a passion about something.
Yeah.
And I think that society today just trains that out of people
and turns
us into tax cows.
Here's what you're missing, though. What if that passion is something where there's maybe a very finite amount of jobs? Like, you know, when I worked in music, everyone wants to get in the music business. And it's like, it's very hard to get in and you need to know a lot. And it's really not for everyone, but everyone, there's so many people that love music.
There's a difference between a obsession or a compulsion and a passion.
Right.
Right. And people can, the glitter and glitz of like marketing, and this kind of talks a little bit about our next topic, the glitter and glitz of like basketball or music, it's very attractive and it's very easy to become entranced by something and be fooled into thinking you have a passion for that. You go to try to make a job in it. There's a limited number of jobs, and you just go to learn to hate your life because you're at the bottom of the ladder.
I agree with that.
It's not necessarily your passion. It's because you got enraptured by the marketing, the glitz, the glamour of all the packaging that they wrap it up beautifully and sell it to you. Well, and that is part of what is beating out people finding their true passions today.
So people being marks.
Yes, and increasingly so.
Yeah.
Right. Prior, when universities actually were a very rare and prestigious event for people to go to, very early on, people had to find other means to make do, right? Mm-hmm. People had to go find work. People had to go find ways to generate value. Now that we're in this society where we actually, like here in the U.S., have a lot of shit taken care of for us, right? Many first world countries are very similar. U.S. is certainly way up there. People lose you not only lose the need to go find something, you lose the desire. And imagine what happens generation after generation. Now that we've got everything we want, right? We've got these nice big farmhouses, four cars in the garage. Like, now that we've got all that, where do you do some real soul seeking and find the passion that's deep inside of you?
Here's what it just doesn't happen anymore. And this is directly in response to that, and it's really easy. You need to start teaching the means to find those answers. And that means the way to find what you're passionate about. And that means learning how to properly Google something. Simple things that I don't know if they're taught now. They weren't in my day, but very simple things. How to access information is a tool anyone can use. It's like Dewey Decimal 2.0.
And I don't know how to do this either. It's like all of this stuff, glitter and glam and glitz, is a fog over everyone's eyes.
Yep.
Like they never get in touch with their real, what's deep inside of their soul, right? And it the society as a whole suffers because people just aren't in touch with that. And education, colleges and universities are just an extension of that larger societal problem.
And as we go to the next topic, I would like to say that the first four letters of marketing are Mark.
Oh, that's profound, Tony. I'm not sure I understand entirely.
Well, did I ever explain what the true meaning of a mark is? Because this is not my pro wrestling term. What would happen is back in the day when people went to carnivals, right? The carnival host would have a little piece of chalk, and he would put a chalk on the mark of the back of a person's jacket or shirt, indicating they're a mark, they're an easy, they're a sucker, they're a fool, sell them whatever you can. That's what a mark is. Okay. So I just want to.
So it's a literal
term.
That's pretty cool.
That's very interesting.
Yes, it's very literal.
So, yeah, we did want to talk about this. I mean, regarding entrepreneurship, one of the things that comes up a lot for people who are thinking about entrepreneurship or who are actually engaged in it, whether they're the founders or people involved in a startup, is sort of the conflict between the perceived conflict between marketing a product and making the product, the real, the traditional stereotypical developer marketer divide. And here at this table, we have two marketers, and we have one hardcore engineer. We all cross over. We're not. We're definitely not defining ourselves in those terms. But it's something I'm sure we've all encountered individually. You know, a lot of aspersions cast on marketers, or a lot of marketing types, maybe ignoring or not giving proper respect to people actually building the product. And I want to talk about with y'all sort of what you think is the right balance, or sort of the right philosophy of where marketing meets making in startup or in any company. What is the value?
I think that's very easy. It's like this one Futurama quote, marketing works best when no one knows you're doing it at all. When you're not trying to really push, you know, one message down everyone's throat and talking about it nonstop. But when you're releasing a good product, you obviously have to get the word out. But there's different ways you can get the word out. You don't have to be obnoxious about it. And when you're obnoxious about it, you fail. When you don't give credit to the people creating the product, you ultimately fail because they're your best marketers, because they know the product inside and out. And I see this as a big problem in Silicon Valley. I saw it when I was at the Collision Conference in Las Vegas. So many startups, so many. And I'm looking at all these, just like looking all over, and I'm kind of like, this is a terrible place to market anything because there's so much noise. Like, you could have the most genius product in the world, and finding an investor in that place would have been impossible. And it really is something where everything needs to be sexy and tell a story. Is the product good? That's the number one question. It's all about the product. Getting something out there, yeah, there is a skill to marketing, and it's relationship building, it's knowing the right channels, how to get in people's, really, you know, how to get into their minds and into their, you know, thoughts. But if the product isn't good, all that doesn't matter at all. A shit product's a shit product. Product means everything.
There's a channel here, right? There is your job as a marketer, and this is where it kind of bleeds into sales, I think, and it hasn't completely coalesced in my mind really what the difference is, but I think they're strongly related. Mm-hmm. And your job is to basically get the word out about a product so that you can find the people that need your product.
Yep.
And there's a channel there, right? There's a channel that you can stay in and truly find the people that actually have the problem that your product solves. And then there's like the once you get a little bit beyond that, you start pushing your product on people who don't need it, right? That's when it becomes just like you're talking about. You're just sort of like shouting from the hilltops about about something that nobody frickin' needs. But speaking very directly though, I think that it has to start with the actual building of what you're making, whatever it is you're doing,
yeah.
Right? Build the thing. It's not build it and they will come. right? That's not the theory. It's build a good product that solves someone's real problems, right? Get it in the hands of a small group of people and iterate and iterate and iterate and empower the people who love your product, the thing that you've built, the service that you provide, whatever it is. Empower the people who love that thing to become marketers for you, to spread the word to other like-minded individuals. Yeah. And I think that a lot of people take marketing as sort of like this mass broadcast approach, right? And what it is it's a little bit, it needs to be a little bit more subtle than that, a little bit more direct to the people who actually have the problem that your product solves. And if you're selling something you don't have, then now you're just total snake oil salesman, and now you're going to let people down in terms of their relationships because, well, you sold me this thing on this idea. Okay, well, where's the product? And if it falls short of those expectations, you've lost that person forever, and heaven forbid, they're never going to become a marketer for you, right?
Exactly. And I remember a distinctive memory of mine is the first time I clued someone into Google. It was the school library in high school, the school librarian. No idea what Google was. She used Yahoo, and I was like, why don't you use this Google site? She's like, it looks really plain. I'm like, yeah, that's the point. It does one thing, and it does it really, really well. Yeah. All this other bullshit is just distracting. And I didn't say it like that because I went to a Catholic school. I was like, yes, but it's really good, ma'am. And then I showed it to her, and you know what? After that, that was the default search engine on the school computer because, well, they had multiple ones, but at least the library's computers. And and that's, I think, how a lot of the great products grow. That's how YouTube, you know, Netflix, a lot of the media is easier. But, you know, really good things like that grow just because people recommend them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with the story of Airbnb or really early on. And it really matches something which Paul Graham of Y Combinator says a lot, which is do things that don't scale when you're early on. And the best marketing they ever did probably was going out and photographing homes of their early users and like helping them get really good listings on Airbnb, like visiting them, asking them for feedback, you know, getting to know their users a lot. That's not marketing in a technical sense, but they were really doing the best marketing there they could have done at that stage. And it was getting sort of the referral, that power going, as you said, Tony, is empower your users to tell your story. Because I feel like if you ever get to a point, and I've had this experience a few times, where either your employees or your customers, and particularly your customers, care about seeing your mission fulfilled and not just you know, care about getting their values, getting customer value, which is very important, but they actually want to see your mission fulfilled and they believe in your story, like people do in Airbnb, that's brilliant marketing. You've really hit an important point there.
But then eventually, you know, it hits the fan, like with Uber. Someone says something dumb, people become less sympathetic to you. But guess what? The service by then is people like it.
You're not a startup anymore at that point,
but
right?
This is very true. Yeah,
like,
you're right.
Once you get to that scale, like, okay, all right, you're not a startup anymore. You're a business trying to make it, right? And, you know, having done several startups previously, you know, it's the same experience. Like, when you get, like, a customer, one customer, it's like,
100% growth.
Oh my gosh. And like you're making all these like promises about what your product does and like it's really good for this. And you get that one customer and then you're just like you do everything in your power to try to help that person succeed. You email them. You say, "Hey, how are things going?" You say like let say you're selling widgets or something like that. You go out and help them sell widgets because
my favorite product,
right? Widget. Acme widgets. It's like, it's 5 stars across the board, man. Acme widgets, Dubai, +++. Yes. Would buy again. So it's like you want to help that first person succeed. And that slowly fades out because that itself as an act is not scalable, right? There's this new field starting to develop called a customer success. It's basically people within the organization that are responsible for, after the sales process, they've already bought the product, helping them succeed with the product. And this is something that a lot of companies miss today, right, that have historically missed. So we've gone through, 20 years of plus of, like, IT, technology solutions, and these companies acquire it, and they drop it in place, and in a lot of places it's like these massive organizations. We are now adopting this, and it's like a six-month or a 12-month rollout of this massive software package that does, I don't know, CRM or something. I'm not targeting Salesforce, but the Salesforce is a great example here, where you've got this tool. It does these things. It's really powerful. It's this case where instead of like going out and selling more of it, why don't you focus your energy on making your existing customers successful? And we've seen numbers of companies. This is a pattern. So we've seen Airbnb, like your example. Salesforce does this. All the companies, Uber does this. All of the companies that have really massive growth, right, very quickly, have focused on the success of their existing customers. Yeah. And that's marketing.
And it's old school. It's customer fucking service. This is exactly the same thing good old Mary's General Store had. If you know the service where it was so good that you wanted to go there, why I prefer small independent hardware stores to Home Depot, because you're going to find some old guy that can fix anything and will tell you what you need in like 2 seconds. I pay for that, and I will almost every time. And, and a lot of people won't pay that premium, and that's a problem, I think. I think that premium is something that, you know, it needs to be investigated more, and they need to quantify it in a financial way more. And I do love what you said about, you know, the product and following up with that. And it really makes me think, though, it's very unique to software. This is unique. You can't do this in almost any other kind of business. When you said we're operating a startup, not a business, I thought that was a very interesting quote. Because you don't operate the two the same at all. I mean, eventually, you're right, a startup becomes a business. But it's very interesting. And I think it's something where a lot of the people that have experience in startups don't always have the experience in business, and they can't cross that bridge. That bridge is a hard one to cross.
It's a chasm. It's not. There's no bridge. You got to fucking jump, build the bridge as you're jumping.
Yeah.
And that's how you cross it.
Style.
Yeah. Exactly. No. There is no bridge. You got to build it.
Yep. You're right. I used the wrong term. But
for the next decade, my read on business and industry and what will be successful is quality is coming back.
Oh yeah.
Like all of this noise that you talk about, especially in Silicon Valley, in a lot of the tech scenes around the world. It's noisy, and you have these people, I don't want to call them wantrepreneurs, but you have wantrepreneurs are just people who show up at tech entrepreneurship events just to kind of socialize and like, yeah, I've got a startup on. There's tons of them. What I'm talking about is people who actually genuinely believe that their app that they're building, which is, I don't know, I don't want to pull out any particular person's ideas, but like
it's probably been made already. Actually, any random combination,
any like little random idea that you could possibly
right,
like totally. That's I'm sure. I guarantee. I think I saw one on Imgur the other
day. Remote control from an app.
Well, they come to these pitch events and they want to sell their product, and they really genuinely think that it's the coolest thing in the world. That it is a viable opportunity for their startup to become a business, and it's just like you. If you've seen, you've been around the ringer a few times, you look at these guys and like, this is a terrible, terrible idea, right? Like, yeah. or it's not even a terrible idea. It's just like, this doesn't do anything. Like, there's no true value here. Like, there if your company is not solving a problem, delivering value, right? What are you doing, right? And there's way too much of that. People, there's so much noise and cruft out there. Quality is going to come back, and there will be a very strong focus on customer service.
Yeah,
I totally think I can feel the pendulum swinging back.
I hope you're right, and I think the last point I really want to make on this was a conversation we had earlier about a very prominent VC investor and an algorithm they have that would help them search out influential people to follow.
Hooli?
No, it was someone. It wasn't. It was C. Montgomery Burns, and he has this algorithm when he's on his Twitter. And, you know, it helps them follow the people that are really influential. And you know what? I don't value that at all. And that people think that's gaming the system. I don't. I think it's impersonal. I think it's kind of, it's something where I don't value that person's communication. I don't value that if that's how they're following me. It's not like I know. But in the same token, a company can have tons of fake social media followers. And I'm pretty sure, you know, the VC world has figured this out by now. But it's also something where it's very easy to have pretend hype, a meerkat pretend hype. Pretend hype to the 10th degree, like there's no more pretend hype. And then, you know, when something is really growing and building and you see it, like with Uber, you see it and you see it in action, you go, okay, this thing's real. This is actually happening. This isn't just BS hype.
Yeah, VCs are not in the position that they are because they look at signals like how many Twitter followers you have.
I don't know that, though.
VCs do not
I think
give,
smart ones.
Yeah, tier one VCs.
Yes, I agree.
Tier one VCs actually are thought leaders. Tier two VCs generally follow the leaders to by and large. They're looking for a good deal. But VC cap investment of this type is all about pattern recognition. They see all of this noise. And they see the ones that have succeeded in their 10 or 15 year, you know, fund, right? Or in some cases, much longer than that. So that it's pattern recognition. They see the traits. They see the qualities of entrepreneurs and products and services that actually do rise above that cruft. And if you're an entrepreneur that's listening to the show, or you're an engineer, or you're a designer or a marketer, figure out what you can do to stand out from the crowd. That something that really truly delivers value to somebody, right? True value, not just a cool little idea, but a value. Find a problem, solve it, then sell it.
Mm-hmm. And something that seems so hard to do nowadays, especially, again, in this kind of land of hype that we seem to be in, is like really building a career and a reputation that lasts and that like stands for quality, like you said. Our next guest has that reputation. He's been building open source in Bitcoin for, I don't know, I think 6 years perhaps, probably longer.
It's been six. We'll let him elucidate his career.
Absolutely. But Ryan X. Charles, and I'm very curious because I've been in this industry for a much shorter time. but I'd like to kind of hear from Eric and Tony. Who have you seen, not just in open source, but in maybe the tech community in general, who you think has a really great career? What do you think defines a good career and a good reputation? And how can people go about really building that in this in the midst of all this hype?
So one of the guys that I sort of followed very early on. So I got into web development fairly early, I suppose. jQuery was not a thing, right? And it kind of is becoming not a thing now, which is cool because I saw the rise and fall of a software package that helped a lot of people out. Paul Irish has a really good, I don't want to call it a career arc because he's continuing to follow a very good trajectory right now. You know, he started very early on adopting technologies at a very early age, early in technology's age, right. Putting them to use, learning, mastering them, telling other people how to master them, and really getting the word out. And this speaks a lot about sort of perhaps the best strategy for establishing a reputation, I think, is if it's something that's making you successful, you got to be passionate about something to master something like that, right? Open source is like, go tell people about it, right? Yeah. Master it, and then go tell people about it. Tell people, help other people succeed. And this gets back to one of our earlier topics. Like, help other people succeed, and people will look to you to be that leader because you just adopted something that was hot off the presses. Nobody knew anything about it, right? Maybe you even created the damn thing. And then you built really cool things with it. You gave them away, right? And then you taught other people how to do the same stuff.
Yeah, and what seems to be really unique about open source is that it's trustless in the sense that everyone can verify your code, but it's also very reputation-based. Like by doing things which don't require a reputation, like releasing your code, you build a really good reputation that way. Like, it seems that way from GitHub. It's like almost like a social network now.
Yeah.
And you know, seeing interaction of developers I know with someone like Ryan, I mean, like, you can really define yourself as an individual contributor and entrepreneur almost,
sure.
Even whether you work for a company or not. Like, you can continue to work for these projects, things you care about, and share that with other people.
And let me point out, too, that it's about a lot more than software engineering, right? Software.
Sure, yes. Like, because mine was not going to be a software engineer.
You call me a software engineer. I'm not an engineer, man. Like, I can code. I just happen to have a skill. Like, I don't call myself an engineer or barely even a coder.
Yeah.
Like, I have an array of things that I do. So, like, open source, the philosophy applies to, we can expand it slightly from software to hardware, right? We can expand it to business strategies. We can expand it to philosophies. It's this idea that you can't own an idea, right?
Right.
You can't own something that is non-tangible. It is non-tangible. It cannot be possessed, right? So intellectual property is bullshit. So let's get that off the table. But it's this idea that we can do better by sharing, by delivering value to people, right? And in some cases, people will pay for it. Open source doesn't mean not paid, mm-hmm. right? You can buy open source software. It's free as in libre, right? Not free as in gratis. Like, there's billion-dollar companies out there, Red Hat, for example, that make money on open source software.
Yeah.
But it applies to everything. This idea that by giving stuff away, you build a reputation, and it applies to many more things than just software.
Yeah, and the two that I have that aren't software, one was our guest, Steve Albini, just admires business practices. He refuses to take royalty points. He treats his artists fair, and he's maintained a consistent customer base for years, which in music, you know, usually there's a hot producer for a minute, and then you kind of die out. Albini's been in demand for what, 20 years? And the other one is someone a little different. Since we spoke with him, I don't want to go too much into detail, but Stuart Brand, who created the Whole Earth Catalog, and I think that is a great idea. He gave everyone the Whole Earth Catalog. To the listeners who don't understand, really, I think is the one of the beginnings of the decentralization movement. It really is the root of it, and it was a catalog where you could buy tools that would or information or books to teach you a skill that you would need to learn to live without any outside interference. So if you wanted to learn how to plant some kind of crop, it would tell you the best way or give you the place to find out where to do this. And this existed in print form for what, a decade, and he influenced so many people, and really in software a lot, but he's one that I really admire, and it created really not the open source movement, but more the, you know, you can help build this too movement, because I don't know if that's the same thing. I think open source really is really, when I hear it, I just think of technology and IT and software, even though it's not the truth. That's what I think most people think. So perception's reality there.
Well, I was going to ask, you're talking about Steve Albini, which, by the way, if our listeners have not gone back and listened to that interview, that was perhaps one of the best that I've heard personally from my own show. So thank you, Tony, for doing that.
Thank you, guys.
So as you're saying that, I was like, what is it called? It's not called the master, but it's the full composition, all of the tracks that go into the final master, right?
Right.
What is that called? Is it the composition?
It's basically, I would believe the, I mean, I was always referred to them as the master.
Okay.
The master, there's tracks that go into the master, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So how cool would it be if some musicians or producers started actually, instead of like just giving away their music, giving away all of the tracks
they
and composition.
They do. Trent Reznor does it for all that's of to remix all of it. They always give stems out. Absolutely. Really stems, innovative artists. They call them stems a lot, but that's less of a master term and more just, you know, what those little parts are called. And the stems term is something where they have done that for a few years. With Steve, though, it's more of a, you know, people are paying for his service. So he's charging for his time.
Yeah, totally.
And his equipment. And you know, he's charging for that. And he's charging a fair price. It's not cheap, but it's not considering how much people will pay for like an A-list Bob Rock is just one I think of when I think of just bad producers. Sorry if you're listening, Bob Rock, but I know you're not. Sorry, the guy that made Motley Crue and all the worst Metallica records is not listening to our podcast. But when you think of people like that, you know, they aren't exactly about to give out their give up their royalties just because they want to work with an unsigned artist that really are hungry, even if they don't like their music, because he respects what they do. That to me is what running a business is. And thank you for the comment. And I he's one of my heroes, so I would encourage anyone that you know enjoys anything I ever say to listen to that, because he has this reputation. He's a cranky old man, and he's not. He's smart, and he's just fantastic.
Today we're joined by Ryan Charles, who's a former astrophysicist who's gone on to lead cryptocurrency projects at companies including BitPay and Reddit, and is currently the lead engineer at BitGo. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here, Eric.
Awesome. We're really excited about this one. We just wrapped up a really awesome talk segment where we talked a little bit about academia and sort of the university system and how it's sort of falling by the wayside. I know most of your history, but can you talk about, you know, where you came from? You were in astrophysics, right? You're doing your PhD. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So I guess at this point it was maybe approximately 10 years ago, I decided to become a physicist. And I was in college at the time. I read a book on physics, and I was very motivated about it. And I thought the prospect of spending my life doing physics was just awesome. I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. So I started studying physics. I went to grad school. I was in grad school for about 6 years studying high-energy astrophysics. And towards the end, I think it was the last 2 years of grad school for me, I discovered Bitcoin. And, you know, I still love physics to this day. I'm very motivated about physics. But Bitcoin was just this incredible opportunity, the way I saw it. I thought that the potential to really change the world was just absolutely enormous with Bitcoin. So I had been in grad school for about 4 years at that point, had been, you know, studying physics for a total of about six. When I discovered Bitcoin, and Bitcoin was sort of a hobby. So I, stayed in grad school. I kept spending, you know, my days doing physics research. But, you know, basically at night or on weekends or whatever, I'd read about Bitcoin. I was on the Bitcoin forum and stuff back then. I didn't do very much programming when I first discovered it. I was just sort of a hobbyist, sort of an advocate. I tried to get people to adopted. I tried to get people to accept it for for selling stuff or whatever. About 2 years into that, so that was early 2011 when I discovered it, and early 2013, about 2 years later, Bitcoin had just basically grown dramatically, and it became big enough that I realized that I could make Bitcoin my career. So I decided to leave physics and go full-time Bitcoin.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to know, when you were left physics, and what exactly did you learn in that role that may have carried over, you know, to what you were doing in Bitcoin and the various roles you've had since?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think there's a lot that I learned. It's really difficult to sort of separate from what did I learn from grad school specifically and what would I have learned anyway. So obviously I learned a lot about physics. The actual body of knowledge of physics is mostly not useful to me, just because obviously I'm not focused on, you know, most of the stuff that I knew is just not useful to me in my daily, you know, life. Some stuff I learned was very valuable. I mean, I really advocate at least having a basic understanding of physics to everyone, just because people don't realize the decisions they make in their life often are based on either an understanding or a misunderstanding of physics. So it's very easy, and there are lots of common misconceptions in physics. So the best thing anybody can do is just at least study enough physics that you can correct your misconceptions. So for instance, in a vacuum, objects of different masses will all accelerate at the same rate. People think they will fall, you know, the heavier thing falls faster. That's not true. They fall at the same rate. So there are countless misconceptions like that. So obviously, those basic things I learned, that's very helpful. There are lots of other just, you know, there's one field of study that I learned that's really, really useful, which is called Bayesian probability theory. I don't do Bayesian probability theory calculations or anything like that on a daily basis, but there's a philosophy of this, and it's basically the philosophy of uncertainty, and that's very, very useful to me. I think about the world in terms of what I don't know rather than what I do, because that's just how it is. I don't know most things, and Bayesian probability theory gives me like a framework to understand, you know, what I know and what I don't know. So that's probably the most useful sort of, you know, mathy, sophisticated thing I learned in grad school. So there's a lot. But I also wonder, you know, had I not gone to grad school, what else would I have learned? I would have learned different things, but it's hard to separate, you know, what did I learn that was, you know, something I couldn't have learned elsewhere? And so that's harder to say. I mean, I learned very academic-y, mathy things, but I'm sure I would have learned other valuable lessons had I not spent so much time in academia.
And as a follow-up to that, the Bayesian probability theory, so it was something they actually taught you in grad school. You actually learned that there.
It was not. So I like sort of went out of my way to study this. That's a great question. So I didn't actually take courses on Bayesian probability theory. This was something I learned myself to help with my own research. I learned, sort of basic statistics when I was in college, but we didn't learn very much detailed. So I sort of went out of my way to really, really enhance my own understanding of this because I was an experimental physicist. And what that means is basically focusing on, rather than on coming up with theories or something, I was focused on running experiments and analyzing data and trying to either validate theories or try and, you know, basically arrive at new discoveries that maybe aren't covered by theories or whatever. And we need statistics and we need probability theory to do experiment. So I learned it for my own sake. It wasn't something we learned, you know, that I learned anyway in a class. It was something I learned mostly just by being, you know, motivated to understand it and to learn what I knew I needed to know to do the work that I had to do.
Ryan, while we're on the topic of learning, this is a very interesting one to me, especially having that, like, being so young, kind of really being in this industry so, and learning so much in the past few months. I'd like to know what you would recommend to young people maybe who are getting into Bitcoin, who really love the idea of the technology but don't understand the architecture of it or don't understand, you know, how to program how to actually make computers work for you instead of obviously you working for them. What would you recommend as the single best habit or tool you've adopted to master the work you do?
Sure. So I've been programming for a very long time now, since I was a kid. And I've used, many different programming languages, many different technologies over the years. These days, I write primarily JavaScript, and I use, Mongo for the database and stuff. I use hip modern technologies, but I've used many, many things over the years. The best thing for me is just to want to build something and just figure out how to actually build it. Almost everything I know about software, I've learned by just trying to do it and having to figure out, what don't I know? What do I need to learn so that I can do it? So the absolute best thing you can do, it's not about choosing any particular technology or programming language or whatever. It's about just having a project and trying to do it. And you just have to figure out, what do I need? If you're making a website, you have to learn some basics about HTML and JavaScript if you want to do that. If you're making, any conceivable other thing, maybe you like Raspberry Pis and you want to, play with your lights or something by programming Raspberry Pi, you will figure it out. So my number one suggestion for anybody who's sort of a beginner is to just come up with a project, what is something cool that you want to do, and just spend enough time so that you can figure out everything you need to figure out to do it. So just for a weekend or a week or for a month, just focus on it and make that project happen.
So I think open source is a big part of being able to sort of consume and understand projects like that. Like I know for a fact that I don't think I would have gotten where I am today in terms of software engineering if I hadn't such a wide body of work that I could go look at and reference. And I know you have a very extensive open source presence. I know you spend a lot of time on GitHub, I'm sure. What are some of the unique things about the open source flow, the open source model? What are some interesting things that people who don't do software development on a day-to-day basis might find interesting about the whole open source and GitHub ideas?
Yeah, that's a really great point. So I'm very involved in open source. I wish I could contribute more than I do, actually. I mean, I've contributed quite a lot. But not everything I program is open source. It is so valuable to me. Like what you just said about being able to look at the source code for things is if I couldn't do that, I would be way less productive. Like there's absolutely no question. Like being able to just look at how other people solve problems is extremely valuable. I do it all the time. Like almost every time I'm interacting with somebody else's software or service or something, where possible, I just read their source code and then I understand, what I'm dealing with. So that's extremely valuable. I could go on about the subject of open source a lot. I mean, obviously, I'm very, very pro open source, as you guys all are. Anytime you go about writing something not open source, you should have a very, very good reason for it not being open source. Open source should be the default. It's extremely valuable to write software and to be able to read other people's software and use other people's software that's open source.
So how does sort of the open source philosophy intersect with your own philosophy that you described earlier? How has it really influenced your work? How has it affected your approach to Bitcoin in general?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I've been involved in open source. I mean, I've been at least interested in open source for almost as long as I've been, involved in writing software and stuff. But I sort of became particularly interested in it because of Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is only possible because of open source. So I like to say there are three principles to Bitcoin. And not just Bitcoin, but what I call the whole crypto finance space. One is that it's voluntary, one is that it's decentralized, and one is that it's open source. These three features distinguish Bitcoin and other crypto finance technologies from everything else. It's what makes it different from the traditional financial system. It's what makes it different from so many other projects and undertakings in the world. So it's so absolutely key. It's like a part of my very philosophy that open source software is, it's literally a principle of this space, of the crypto finance space. So for me personally, like, you know, I do write closed source software. And I guess the reason for that is, you know, I sort of find myself in situations where basically other people have built things that it only makes sense for me to contribute to it if it's closed source. Like, I can't be the one responsible for making it open source. So here at BitGo, we have, I would say most of our software is actually closed source. We have some open source things. We contribute to open source stuff. But our primary code base is closed source. So this wasn't my decision. I mean, this was, you know, this was a decision made by the people who, you know, created it originally. So we can't just dump the source code out in public because that would be a security problem. You know, there could be lurking security flaws in our software that we haven't found yet. So we have to be very careful how we, you know, iterate in the direction of open source software. So one thing we do is new projects we create are open source. I'm working on a new project right now that's open source from day one. I haven't published it yet because it's just a work in progress. But I think that's, you know, that's sort of my strategy. Like, I think, you know, it's so absolutely critical. This whole space wouldn't exist if not for open source. So we have to, you know, we have to be a part of that ecosystem. If we try and separate or go off into some, you know, closed source world or something, no one would use our software. We'd be... We wouldn't be, people couldn't do what we were talking about a minute ago, where, like, you know, I look at other people's source code to figure out how it works. If people can't do that for ours, then, you know, they're hampered. They won't be able to interact with us. They won't be able to use our stuff as well. So I think it's just in our interest to do as much open source as possible.
And as a follow-up to that, go into a little bit about the Innovators Patent Agreement, because there's been some talk about it, and we would really like to hear what you have to say, you know, representing BitGo and, you know, the projects you're working on.
Yeah, so the Innovators Patent Agreement is this sort of a declaration by Twitter. I guess they were the ones who created it. It's about, so a patent, of course, is sort of this claim to an innovation, and it's a legal thing. It's purely legal. It is, you know, the government acknowledges that you own this concept. And they, you know, this enables you to use the law, if you own a patent, to, you know, basically force people to pay you for, you know, the use of this patent. Or at least that's one use of it. Another use is that it sort of defends you against other people that might use patents against you. So if you own a patent, you know, somebody else can't use, you know, that patent or a similar one against you because... you know, you own the particular idea or whatever. So patents make people like myself and a lot of us in the space very uncomfortable because it's not, you know, like Bitcoin was not a patent. You know, like this would never have made any sense if it had been patented. It would not be possible. You know, no one would be, we wouldn't be able to freely just build stuff on Bitcoin if there was some company somewhere that owned a patent on Bitcoin. Nobody would build on it. We would just go build a different thing that did something similar but not based on the same ideas so that we could just freely build on it. So patenting things is a very uncomfortable idea to those of us in the space. However, I think there are legitimate reasons to create patents if you are defending yourself against others. So that's exactly what Mike Belshi did. I guess it was about a year and a half ago when he patented, in a nutshell, multi-sig web technology, and it's basically the particular way the BitGo wallet works involving like encrypting private keys, sharing it between a server and stuff. He created a patent of this idea, and he filed a patent, so there's no official, it hasn't been granted or anything yet. But you know, like other people in the space, you know, he doesn't want to own this idea. So we've committed as a company to following this Twitter patent agreement or whatever it's called. And what this is it basically says, A, we commit to not using this patent offensively. So I don't know if there's any legal way to do this. It's basically just a public commitment to not using it offensively. We commit to only using it defensively. And also the way the ownership of the patent is created Mike Belshi and the other guy who's not at BitGo. I don't know the story of the other guy that's on the patent, but it's Mike Belshi and another guy, whose name I think is James. They will forever own the patent. That way, if BitGo is ever bought by another company, let's suppose, for instance, BitGo, we sold ourselves to, you know, Google or something or whatever, just some other company. That company might not agree with our stance that we don't want to use this patent offensively. So this Twitter patent agreement says that, you know, basically the control of the patent stays with the authors. So they can, you know, they have to, like, approve any uses of the patent or something like that so that any future owners of the patent cannot use it offensively. So that's the idea of the patent agreement. I'm very uneasy about it, to be honest. I mean, like, I don't really have a better solution, because the reality is companies, you know, there are patent trolls out there that if we don't own any patents, we're sort of setting ourselves up to be attacked by one of these patent trolls. So I think there's a good argument to be made to be used it for purely defensive reasons. I feel like, you know, Bitcoin and related technologies make it possible, in my mind, to completely replace all of these traditional information technologies, such as patents. You can, for instance, one way you could solve this problem with Bitcoin is you can just create a document that, you know, defines what your idea is, what your technology is, hash it, and put the hash in the blockchain, and now you can prove at any future date that you have that idea at that time. There doesn't need to be a government, you know, or a central organization of any kind, you know, affirming the existence of this patent. You can use technology to do that. So that's just the first step, but there are lots of other ways we could use technology to get around patents. But in any case, for right now, the situation we're in is we're trying to use patents purely for defense. I think, you know, there's sort of a conversation we've had with other Bitcoin companies. This is something independent of BitGo I've talked with a lot of people about in the space. We could, as a community, do things like, you know, create a new organization like the Bitcoin Foundation. Some people wanted the Bitcoin Foundation to do this. The Bitcoin Foundation could hold patents that are, you know, Bitcoin-related patents. That would be one way to, like, try to remove the concern over using patents offensively. We could also do something where maybe it's not a separate organization, maybe different Bitcoin companies come to some contract with each other not to use their patents offensively against one another. Those are all ideas. So I don't know what the end result of all this is going to be, but I think we're in the middle of, technology is changing so fast that patents, I hope, will be completely obsolete soon, but it's not the case yet. So that's it. That's our situation.
That's a really good answer, Ryan. I really like this idea that we may not need legal frameworks or governments to sort of enforce these things. Whether or not you agree with the idea of intellectual property, agree with this idea that you can even own somebody's thoughts, that's irrelevant for now. I do agree with you, and I think that they will go away eventually, but we're not there yet. I think what you're getting at, though, is that there's a wider use for the blockchain, and it doesn't necessarily have to be Bitcoin. And I know you've been involved in a number of other projects that have done some very interesting things, such as proof of existence. But what I want to get at now is sort of your experience with Reddit and their crypto, what I presume was a crypto equity, where they were considering offering partial ownership of Reddit as a crypto asset. Can you talk a little bit about your experience there?
Yeah, so I joined Reddit for a lot of reasons. I think there was and there still is a lot of potential at Reddit for cryptocurrency technology, for crypto finance technology, for Bitcoin, and for all the related things. Reddit is this uniquely large, purely internet community. You know, it's like a Reddit is an example of, in my opinion, what Neal Stephenson talked about when he talked about files. So this is a concept from his Neal Stephenson's science fiction author. A file is like a group of sort of like-minded people that share values not unlike a nation state, although not at any particular location in physical space. They're just sort of related, and they have a community, and they have their own rules, but it doesn't have to be any one place, just like Reddit. It's this you know, internet community where the people live all over the world. And this community could use a financial system. They need a way to pay each other, either pay each other money or to share in equity or whatever. Have literally a financial system for this file that is Reddit. So I think there's huge potential for that at Reddit. Reddit is much more appropriate for this than, say, Facebook. Reddit is pseudonymous. You know, the users on Reddit are not, they're not attached to their real world identities. It's whatever. You can make a new username, you know, at any moment and create a new identity for yourself. That's a very internet way to do things. Facebook's not like that. Facebook's real identity. It's way too close to the real world. Reddit is purely internet. It's perfect for crypto finance. So I joined Reddit for this sort of big picture view of what we were going to do. And it was, I believe it was primarily the CEO's idea to launch what we were calling a cryptocurrency. But it wasn't just a currency. It was going to be issuing, ideally, ownership of the company to the users of Reddit. So this would be a way for us to literally give ownership of the community to the users. So that's what we were creating. We were trying to create, it's a crypto equity. For legal reasons, we were trying to figure out how to not make it an equity, because if you look into the law of any of this stuff, you're like, as soon as you issue, equity, you are basically, if you issue equity to a lot of people anyway, I think it's like over 500 people, you're legally a public company. And then you have to follow a whole bunch of laws over what it means to be a public company. Well, that's fine in some cases. This would have been totally inappropriate for Reddit. Like, for one thing, the users would have to give up their personal identifying information to be able to have ownership, right? You have to reveal what your real name is. Well, almost all Reddit users are not, they don't use their real name. They're pseudonyms. So for legal reasons, we're trying to figure out, basically, if we can't give people equity, what can we do? But either way, we were going to give people something of value that ideally would represent as much ownership as we could give them without making it an equity. There's a whole long story there, which I'd be happy to share if you're curious. I've shared it in other places, but in a nutshell, legally it was so challenging that Reddit was basically changed its mind about undertaking this project. So I think there's still a lot of potential for crypto finance technology at Reddit, but Reddit is probably, they basically have too much other stuff on their hands to be able to tackle this giant project. Like, this would be a multi-year, probably at least millions of dollars, probably maybe tens of millions of dollars in legal fees to figure out how to do this and do it legally and pay for any possible licensing and stuff like that. So it ended up being, just purely for legal reasons, such a large project that Reddit is probably not going to do it anytime soon. I think they're officially still going to do it, but I no one is working on it at the company, to my knowledge.
God, that's really such a shame. Like, it sounds like Reddit is such a perfect fit for this sort of new way of giving ownership over something to the people who are participating in it. Like, this is a totally, it's been an idea previously, but it's never really been possible technically until very, very recently. And it strikes me that, the only reason that this isn't happening is because the government is basically coming, because of the existing legal frameworks. And it's going to take a long time for that to all get sorted out, and that's just a shame. Can you talk a little bit about what you think this sort of friction between regulation and where we are today, and innovation, like what Reddit was trying to do, and what many other companies are also trying to do, but are increasingly having to leave the United States to actually go build these things solely for legal reasons?
Yeah, that's a very, very, very good question. So, there's sort of the general problem of innovative companies and regulation, just sort of period. Then there's the special case of the financial system. And the reason why the financial system is a special case is, A, it's highly, highly regulated. B, the government has sort of a special interest in controlling the financial system. So I like to say it's just by far and away the most regulated industry. I mean, the government literally creates the money, right? It has a monopoly on the very core of the financial system. Although it's not really the government, it's the Federal Reserve, which is, you know, technically a private corporation. But it's basically corrupt. I mean, it's basically the banks and the government basically become one when we're talking about money and the banks and stuff. So there's a big conflict, which is, you know, I don't think that the banks are uninnovative. I think that, you know, they're made up of people, and they're very smart people, and I think a lot of them are actually very innovative people. But they've constructed a system that is just at its core is reliant on the law to create, you know, the structure of this system. And I think the whole notion of law is what's changing. The whole notion of having people decide what happens. So, for instance, if a judge declares, you know, this is the outcome, or someone who's, you know, at a financial system says, or in a financial, you know, in a bank or something, the person literally uses their brain power to decide whether or not a transaction is valid or not. That's a very human-powered, structure, which is basically obsolete. You know, Bitcoin, no human being decides whether a transaction is valid. It's determined automatically by a network of computers all over the world, right? And this can now work for money. It can work for everything else. So there's a conflict, which is, for one thing, the banks have an interest in preserving the status quo, because they're literally like life and death dependent on this, right? If the nature of money is fundamentally changed into something different, then a lot of these businesses are just going to go away. A lot of people are going to lose their jobs. They're going to be their assets are going to go to zero. They don't want that to happen. So just like the music industry didn't want, you know, digital music, the banks don't want this stuff to change. So there's a great conflict there between basically this new technology and the people that have built the system and rely upon the system and have interests in not improving, you know, the way things work. So you mentioned that, you know, some people will just leave the United States. So I've personally lived in the U.S. my whole life. You guys, I don't know if you've lived here your whole life, but, I've lived here for my whole life. I wouldn't want to leave, but it's literally for years now has been on, you know, my periphery that, you know, if I have to leave, I will, because what might actually happen is, you know, with the new laws in New York, the Bit license, there are talks of regulations in all the states and stuff. You know, worst case scenario is it's just like what I'm trying to do is literally illegal, and so the only way I can do it is to go to another country. And that's literally like, you know, it's a totally, you know, a lot of people have already made this choice in the space. A lot of people have moved to Switzerland. There are companies that are based in Switzerland that would have otherwise been based in the U.S., had the regulations not been so awful in the U.S. This is already happening. And another element to all this is that because the internet enables you to do business from anywhere, and Bitcoin, now we've got money that you can earn money from anywhere, there's like nothing tying people down. So you can just leave the country and go to another country. So long as they sort of accept you, you can just move and keep doing business in another country. So I think the reality is what will probably happen is there's going to be enormous pressure on governments. People will just leave, and they'll realize, like, well, you know, what are we going to do? If we keep creating hostile regulation, this is going to be an absolute disaster because the people are just leaving, and they're going to other countries that are more suitable. So I think they're going to be pressured to, tone down the completely ridiculous regulation. Because otherwise, the economy will just fail, right? I mean, like, you know, I don't know if it'll outright fail, but it's not going to be good for anybody in the U.S. if they just make this stuff illegal. People will just leave.
I love these observations, Ron, because I think you see the big picture as well as kind of the effect of this technology on the individual. And I do think it's possible in the Bitcoin space to miss the the trees for the forest, and I didn't get that backwards. Like we see the big picture of how governments and Bitcoin are clashing, or these technologies in general, but we don't see how this affects the individual. And you talked a little bit about, you know, becoming an expatriate, finding ways of doing business with Bitcoin that are maybe more decentralized, maybe more for systemd. I'm very interested in sort of, if you have any thoughts on, any additional thoughts on how people can start using decentralized technologies now, distributed technologies now, or just regular old digital technology, to become more free as individuals without waiting on these massive sea changes?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I'll just state what you just said is like true. You can today use these technologies to be a more free individual already. No one is actually stopping you from building some innovative technology, you know, on the web using Bitcoin. You can do it. Now, what happens is people will threaten you. So the government, you know, if you build something that, you know, that verges on money laundering, you know, which in my opinion, money laundering should not be considered a crime, but the government does consider it a crime. So, you know, you can be threatened. But you can also do things like, you know, hide your identity. So, you know, you don't have to broadcast, you know, your social security number or something like that. If you want to create a business for yourself, that's, you know, I only encourage people to do, you know, legitimate businesses. But, you know, you can do whatever you want and hide your, you know, your identity so that people can't, you know, come and arrest you or whatever, right? People do this already. So this is, you know, obviously the Silk Road, Silk Road 2, and whatever the new dark markets are. I don't like using them as examples because there's a lot of, you know, there's some legitimate activity, but there's also genuine, you know, criminal activity on these dark markets. But the reality is it's already happening. So, I mean, people already do this. You can do things like, send money to your family members in other countries, or send money to your friends or whatever. You know, what if you know, your family's today living in a country where for legal reasons you just can't get money to them? Maybe they're corrupt or whatever. You can just send money to them using Bitcoin, and there's just literally no barrier. You can do that right now. So the technology makes that possible already. So I think there's there are two issues here. One is sort of continuing to build the technology, because the technology is not ready for completely mass adoption yet. I think there are lots of scaling problems with Bitcoin and with everything else. Like, it's just, if 7 billion people tried to start doing this stuff, it just would fail because it's not ready for that type of scale. So there's the technical problem. There's also the social problem of people are just not realizing what is now already possible. The fact that you can literally move to another country and earn a real high income internationally, and by starting a business in another country, you don't have to pay income tax. You can completely avoid paying income tax today. If you move to Panama, you create a corporation in Panama, and the rules in Panama, there are still laws, and you know, you'll be I wouldn't advocate breaking the law, but completely legally, you can move to Panama today and start a business. And so long as your business is international, that the law is literally the case that you don't have to pay income tax. So that's already the case. You can do that right now. You can go move to Panama. Now, Panama is not the right place, you know, for everybody. But already today, the technology enables much, much greater freedom than I think most people have even tried to take advantage of.
You know, it's really interesting. Like we're in the throes of this massive revolution, and that's what it is. It's a complete change in the way everything works. Bitcoin itself applies to finance. The crypto equity thing applies to, you know, corporate ownership, and there's a number of other things that are out there. I mean, decentralized voting, governance, all sorts of things. The world doesn't change overnight, and we're in the thick of this, right? And we're sort of like looking at, you know, oh God, it's taking so long, all these regulations are so difficult. But then once it's all happened, and we're going to look back and be like, holy crap, the world did change overnight, is what it's going to look like on the other side. So as you're working on some of these other projects, one thing we haven't talked about yet is BitGo.
What is your sense of what it's like on the ground to be a part of this? Do you feel that same undercurrent that it's like taking forever, or do you really feel like things are moving quickly? What's your take on it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It feels like things are going slow, like on a daily basis, because I'm like, come on, let's make this stuff happen already. But exactly what you said, like I sit back and I sort of look at more of the big picture of it, and I think things are actually happening very, 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 very fast. I think, in 5 or 10 years, we're going to look back, so much stuff is going to have happened. Like everything that we see happening now, like Wall Street is presently in the process of adopting Bitcoin. And this is like incredible. I mean, like 4 years ago, when I discovered Bitcoin, Bitcoin was so small, like, it was a joke to say that one day Wall Street would be like investing in a Bitcoin company, right? But it's actually now happening. This is happening. Wall Street, they're not just investing, they're like building on top of Bitcoin. Like NASDAQ has their new, their new colored coins thing or whatever. That's absolutely incredible. So I think in the big picture here, things are happening very fast. Bitcoin is only, I think it's 6 years old, right? 2009 until 2015. So it's a little bit over 6 years. That's really short. I mean, that's a small fraction of my life. It's a small fraction of your guys' lives. It's absolutely amazing how big it's grown in 6 years. In another 6 years, it's going to be far larger. It's going to be orders of magnitude larger, I think. I mean, I could be wrong. But I think it will be. I think it's growing very fast. So I think on the time scale of, like, human civilization, this is happening in a flash. It's happening in a single generation, right? People that are adults now, their children are going to grow up in an absolutely, completely different world. In a single generation, things are completely different. So I think that's the big picture is it's happening very fast. It doesn't feel that way being on the ground because I guess I see, maybe I just see how much potential there is, and I feel like we're far away from fully achieving that potential. But, when I sit back and look at, it's only been 6 years. I mean, it's happening very, very fast.
That's very well said, Ryan. I think this is a case where people miss the forest for the trees, actually, of the day-to-day grind of working in Bitcoin. But there's also something very satisfying about that, knowing you're building what you're talking about. And before we close, we'd kind of like to ask what you're building right now. What can we expect from you, maybe to see from your work at Bitco? And what can our listeners check out right now on GitHub that maybe you're contributing to on your spare time?
Sure. So, let's see. So first of all, in a nutshell, I joined BitGo because we're focusing on what I think is one of the most important problems in Bitcoin right now, which is security. We're a Bitcoin security company. We're trying to make it easier for people to not get hacked and not lose their Bitcoins. Or if they do get hacked, they still don't lose their Bitcoins because it's multi-sig, right? So I am committed to solving that problem. It's a more near-term problem than some of the, more grandiose colored coins or even, Ethereum or something like that. I'm more in favor of these basic problems that I think have to be solved first. So that's the big picture of what I'm doing here at BitGo. I'm working on a few things. The only thing I think I've done publicly at BitGo so far is just work on our SDK. However, I'm working on at least one other open source project that we'll probably be launching, probably on the order of like a month or so. And I'll just say I don't want to say what it is other than I will say it is a security project, and it is something that should help people improve their security. And it's particularly going to be useful for businesses. Like it's not necessarily something that a consumer would use, but it'll be useful to other Bitcoin businesses. It'll be open source. So that's cool. I wish I could say what it is. I don't want to unveil it yet. But we will launch it probably on the order of months. There are other things. I'm still contributing to some open source projects. Like I have my own Bitcoin library called Fullnode, which has sort of a complicated history with BitPay's BitCore project. But I'm still sort of involved with that, just implementing Bitcoin in JavaScript. I think there's still a need for more of that stuff. So I'm continuing to it's basically my free time that I'm putting into it. My full time effort is focused more on these sort of very specific security problems. But in a big picture, I still I'm trying to contribute to the JavaScript Bitcoin world. And the reason why choose JavaScript is just because this is the best way to reach the most people with the fewest lines of code. You can, by implementing stuff in JavaScript, it automatically works on every platform, and everybody in the world pretty much can run that code.
Ryan, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a fantastic interview.
Thanks a lot, guys. It was awesome.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.